WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a man who is intimately acquainted with Homer, Marge, Bart, and Lisa Simpson. We talk with Al Jean. He's worked on The Simpsons since the start of the series and is a producer and writer of The Simpsons Movie, which is now out on DVD. The voice of Bart is provided by a woman who has become middle-aged while Bart has remained 10 years old. We'll talk with Nancy Cartwright about getting into character. She also does the voices of Nelson Muntz, Ralph Wiggum, and Todd Flanders. And Milo Miles looks at the career of Nils Lofgren, who has a steady job as a sideman for Bruce Springsteen, after many years as a solo artist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Simpsons movie, the big screen adaptation of the long-running animated TV series, has just been released on DVD. Al Jean has worked on The Simpsons since it became a series in 1989. He's currently head writer and an executive producer. The Simpsons is the longest-running primetime animated series in TV history, and most of the head writers from those various years reunited to brainstorm for the film. Terry spoke with Al Jean a few months ago when The Simpsons film was released. The story has a satirical environmental theme. Homer has adopted a pet pig and has no idea what to do with the pig's droppings. So he fills a silo with the stinky stuff, but then can't figure out what to do with the silo. In a move he thinks is pretty clever, Homer dumps the silo in Springfield's already polluted lake, creating an environmental catastrophe. When the townspeople find out, an angry mob gathers in front of the Simpsons' house.
Homer, you have to go out there, face that mob, and apologize for what you did.
I would. I'm afraid if I open the door, they'll take all of you.
No, we won't. We just want Homer.
Well, maybe not you, but they'll kill Grandpa.
I'm part of the mob!
Al Jean, welcome back to Fresh Air. The Simpsons have been on the air nearly 20 years, and the characters never age, which is okay because they're animated. But I think some of them have really kind of changed and changed with the times. You want to choose one or two characters and tell us how you think they've changed?
Well, there have been some changes that weren't intentional, just because although the characters don't age, you know, we the writers certainly have. And right. At the beginning, I think we identified more with the kids because we almost were kids. And as we started to continue doing the show, more plots would come up for Homer. And I think that's, you know, because, you know, we were getting older and we related to him better. And honestly, as the years go by, I'm starting to drift into grandpa territory. So maybe that'll be the next way we go.
Now, what? Just go through the titles that you've had over the years on The Simpsons.
Well, at the beginning, I was called a consulting producer, and the thing was, the people who were turning the shorts into half-hour episodes, which was Jim Brooks, Matt Groening, and Sam Simon, could afford two writers 2 days a week. So my friends didn't want the job. But I basically said, I'll work cheap and I'll work hard. And, you know, seriously, I also felt I wasn't, you know, predicting this was going to be a show that would last, you know, over 400 episodes and turn into a feature film. But I loved Matt's work in Life in Hell. And Sam and Jim, the work they had done on Taxi and Jim and Mary Tyler Moore was the best work I thought had ever been done in television. So I really was excited to take the job, and I thought the show was going to be good, if nothing else. And when it became full-time, I became the showrunner in seasons 3 and 4. And after that, worked on it part-time while I pursued other projects, which a lot of the writers did then. And at every point, I would always sit there and sometime during the day and go, I wish I was back at The Simpsons. So I came back full-time in season 10, and I've been there full-time ever since and have run the show from season 13 till now.
What does it mean to be the showrunner?
Being the showrunner basically means that whatever goes wrong is my fault. I'm involved in all phases. I came up as a writer, so I write. I supervise the writing. I work with the budgets. I direct the actors, audio. I work with the animation directors. I go over the storyboards, edit the audio, edit the picture, work with the composer, Alf Clausen, work on the special effects, the sound effects, the video effects that go into the show. Basically, I involve myself with every aspect of the show and have responsibility for it.
So what was the first Simpsons episode you worked on?
The first Simpsons episode I worked on was the first episode that aired, the half-hour Christmas special in 1989. And the episode was basically written by Sam Simon, Matt Groening, Mike Reese, and myself. And when I first saw it as a, you know, final cut, I was sitting there going, this is the best thing I've ever been involved with. I want to just spend the rest of my career doing this. And little did I dream.
What did you like so much about it?
Well, what I liked was what I had always responded to in Jim Brooks shows, which was it was funny, but there was a warmth to it. And at the end of that episode, Homer didn't get a Christmas bonus, but he goes to the dog track and loses all his money, but then gets a dog that the owner doesn't want, and brings the dog home, and the family's happy with him because he did. And there was a warmth to that that was so wonderful, and, you know, that we, you know, have recaptured on the best moments in the series, that I still get choked up a little thinking about it.
Do you remember the first joke that you contributed to The Simpsons?
I don't remember the first. I know that the very first episode is titled Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire, and I pitched that. I remember the first time I really made Jim Brooks laugh was in that episode. We were talking about the name for the dog, and I had said, you know, it was Christmas, so because it should be a good omen and Homer would want to bet on him, we could say Santa's Little Helper. And then we were doing this thing where Homer came home, and Marge said, "What's the dog's name?" And I pitched, because it had been a greyhound at a racetrack, that Homer goes, "Number 8. I mean, Santa's Little Helper." And he really laughed at that. And I just was going, wow, I made Jim Brooks really laugh. That's exciting.
Were there any characters you created?
Yes. Ralph Wiggum was one of the characters that we created. I also was one of the people that created Phil Hartman's characters, Lionel Hutz and Troy McClure, and comic book guy, and much of the show was in the shorts, and, you know, was elaborated in the series. The first episode featuring Lisa, Moaning Lisa, was from an idea of Jim's, and Mike Reese and I wrote it. And when we did, we said, you know, we've been on shows that were a little sketchier, like Alf or the first Gary Shandling show. We're going to really go for emotion here. And it was something that I was, you know, so proud of when we did it, and I think it really helped make Lisa's character what it became.
You mentioned Troy McClure, one of the Phil Hartman characters. I'm so sorry that Phil Hartman passed away a few years ago.
He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah, you really lost a lot of characters, and I'm sure a great friend when he died. But you know, getting back to Troy McClure, he was this, like, really funny, vain character. There seemed to be a combination of two actors, you know, Troy McClure. I mean, Troy Donahue and
Doug McClure. Both of whom were angered by the name.
Were they really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you describe how you came up with the character?
Well, the name synthesis is a good example of how we come up with things. We were working on a rewrite for a script in which Homer steals Cable, and we wanted to have this movie actor who comes out and, you know, he introduces cheesy products, and he's a guy who's been in these terrible movies. And, you know, we were saying, oh, he should be a combination of Troy Donahue and Doug McClure. We'll call him Troy McClure. And often things aren't, you know, more fleshed out than that. I would read on The Sopranos that, you know, David Chase would know where he wanted to go with everything at the beginning of the season, and it would all be mapped out, and every, you know, thing would be delineated in fine detail. Well, not us. I mean, I can give you another example, which is Principal Skinner. At one point, George Meyer, one of the writers, said, oh, you know, it'd be interesting if he was a Vietnam veteran. And it was just a joke, and it went in the script. And then it turned into something where it was a great character trait, and it gave him real poignancy. And, you know, we rarely, you know, plan things, but they grow organically, like kudzu.
Simpsons writer and producer Al Jean, speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year.
Troy, Mac Parker. Ever hear of Planet of the Apes?
The movie or the planet?
The brand new multi-million-dollar musical. And you are starring as the human.
It's the part I was born to play, baby.
I hate every ape I see, from chimpanzee to chimpanzee. No, you'll never make a monkey out of me. Oh my God, I was wrong. It was Earth all along. You finally made a monkey.
Yes, we finally made a monkey.
Yes, you finally made a monkey out of me.
I love you, Dr. Zaius.
That's Phil Hartman as Troy McClure, singing in the Planet of the Apes musical from the TV series The Simpsons. We'll be back with more of Terry's conversation with Al Jean after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with Al Jean, a writer and producer of The Simpsons Movie, which has just been released on DVD.
Krusty the Clown is this really like old-time Jewish vaudevillian type of comic. And Flanders is the fundamentalist Christian next-door neighbor. Are there like Jewish writers and Christian writers and Catholic writers and atheist writers on the show who like know their territory?
Primarily, the staff throughout the years has been either writers who are Jewish or Catholic. I am a lapsed Catholic, and the thing that happens is if you're writing about your own ethnicity, then you feel like you can be funnier and you don't have to worry about political correctness. So, for example, we did an episode a couple of years ago where we depicted Catholic heaven and it was, you know, a bunch of Irishmen fighting. I'm Irish, so I didn't think that was offensive. I thought it would be really great and, you know, kills me every time I see it. You know, I think that's, you know, the way that these sort of things get into the show. Flanders, I always say, is designed as someone who's too good to be true. And, you know, I actually believe a lot of people who are fundamentalist Christians really like the character. And, you know, to me, Flanders is a much better neighbor than Homer. If I had to pick one to live next to, it would be Ned. So I find it's a portrait that's not sort of a cheap shot, but actually very nuanced and respectful.
He's a very, you know, considerate, loving father and a good neighbor.
And terrific to Homer, despite the things that Homer does to him.
Uh-huh. But what are some of the other sides of him that you've done over the years?
Well, like anything, as we, you know, continue to try to think of stories, we get more nuanced. So we have done things later, we have done things more recently where we'll have Ned, you know, watch TV and monitor it for vulgarisms. Or, you know, we had him making a movie like Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which was a Bible story, filming the Bible the way it's really written, which is pretty violent. And then he got in trouble because nobody wanted to see it. But we also, you know, make him somebody, and he has a big part in the movie where, you know, Bart looks at him and goes, he's a wonderful man, and everything that I don't see in my own father, I see in him. And that's a real conflict in the film.
Well, he's also just so fastidious. this is a very funny moment in the movie. He's putting the kids to bed, and I think like he gave them a little snack.
That's my favorite scene in the film.
Then he has one of those little mini vacuum cleaners that he's like vacuuming their bedclothes with. Basically puts them to bed.
There's a line that he says towards the end of the film where one of his kids goes, I wish Homer was my father, and I pitched, then Ned says, and I wish you didn't have the devil's curly hair. But he says it in such a positive manner. And my wife with his curly hair is like, now you've done it.
You know, speaking of the Bible, there's a joke in the movie, I hope you don't mind too much me giving this away, that where, you know, the family's in church, and I won't give away what's happening in church, but one of the characters says, basically, what should we do? And Homer has the Bible in his hands, and he says, I don't know, there's no answers in this book.
He says, this book doesn't have any answers, and that was my line.
That's your line?
yes. But what it is just so people don't misconstrue it, it's him trying to find a solution for Grandpa, who's having a vision and rolling around on the floor. So the joke is that he's looking through the Bible like an owner's manual, you know, so that he can find a button to push, and that'll take care of Grandpa. And, you know, obviously, then there's the double meaning that people look for answers to life's problems in the Bible. And it gets a big laugh every time that we screen the film. And to me, it's a perfect example of, you know, the double meaning of you know, things that we do on The Simpsons. That scene, too, in the film that you're referring to is one at the beginning of the film where what Jim Brooks wanted to do was he wanted to have a scene that grabbed you and made you say, this is where the plot of the movie starts. And it's what often happens on The Simpsons, where the way the scene is written, we actually conclude there is a very active God who's taking a firm interest in the lives of Springfielders and trying to save them from a terrible fate. And we actually, you know, show more activity, you know, by, you know, God in human life and you know, direct involvement in human affairs than I would say any cartoon on network television.
Let's talk process a little bit. Can you just like walk us through the process of, say, a typical Simpsons show or of the movie? I assume the process was very similar. It probably starts in the writer's room, right?
What happens is that a writer or a couple writers will pitch an idea for an episode. And as the showrunner, I decide which ones we do and don't do. And if it sounds like it's a good idea, and I always think, you know, would Jim Brooks like it? Sometimes I consult with him directly, or, you know, if I think he'll like it, we just go ahead and do it. And that writer will pitch with the group of writers for 3 days, just coming up with jokes, a storyline. The writer goes off, does an outline. I'll read that and give notes with a couple of other producers, tell the writer how to go off and write the first draft of the script. Then that draft is rewritten 6-7 times before the cast gets to see it. We really go over it line by line, story point by story point, joke by joke. We read it with the cast for a group of us that work on the show. Then you see what gets laughs and what doesn't. You see if they're on board for the story. In, you know, extreme cases, but not often, you'll go, oh, this thing doesn't work, or it's too off character, and we'll have to adjust the story too. Then we'll rewrite it for all that, record it on the following Monday. The audio tape is sent to the animation studio where it's storyboarded. And the storyboards are gone over by me and the writer, and they go back and make what's called an animatic, which is a rough black and white version with, you know, some of the animation in and not all of it. And that is screened for us, and we rewrite it again and record new audio. And then it's color animated. And even after the color comes back, we still rewrite it. A story I always tell is that in the early days of the show, we wrote a joke about the Soviet Union. And before the color came back, the Soviet Union broke up, and we had to change the joke. And, you know, because cartoon lip movements are, you know, pretty standard, you can really change what they say and you know, use the same animation. So the difference between that and the movie is the movie was a 4-year process, and the show, it's a 1-year process.
I have a Marge Homer question for you. You know, Homer's really dumb.
Is he?
he's really difficult to put up with sometimes. And you know, Marge is always, well, often so kind of like stable and able to, you know, have everybody make up and be a family. No matter what Homer does, no matter how stupid it is, at the end, he and Marge usually reconcile, and the family's back together again.
Always reconcile.
Always reconcile, yeah. Do you ever, is ever a part of you that thinks, Marge, leave him. He's really stupid.
Yes, and that's the sort of feeling that, you know, we explore a little in depth in the film. What I think is, you know, one essential basis for the success of The Simpsons is Homer never does anything consciously mean, especially not to Marge. He's insensitive, and he's made every mistake you can make, but he loves her, and he doesn't want to hurt her for anything. And then on the other hand, Marge thinks Homer's the handsomest man she ever met.
Well, and like as Homer says in the film, you have to understand, I don't think about anything.
Yes. And then he goes, I respect people who do, but yeah, that's a Jim Brooks line. It's really, really funny.
So but there,
also a good philosophy that a lot of us, I think, obey.
But there isn't a part of you that thinks, Marge, leave him.
All the time, yeah. I mean, you know, there definitely is a you know, a recurring topic in the writers' room, which is, what does she see in him? And Julie Kavner is really funny because she goes, Homer must be great in bed. And when Julie says it, it's really funny to hear it coming out of her voice.
Can animated characters get away with certain things that actors can't in a sitcom?
Absolutely. One of the biggest we always talk about is Homer strangles his son. I mean, he actually puts his hands around Bart's neck and chokes him. And I think in real life, that would be, Homer would go to jail. It'd be horrific. But in a cartoon, he does it. And then, you know, I mean, Bart's eyes bug out. I mean, it's really pretty scary when you look at it. But then he just lets go and Bart's fine. And it's a cartoon. Everything's cool.
Well, Al Jean, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Al Jean, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. He's a writer and producer of the new Simpsons movie, which is now out on DVD. And he's worked on the TV show since it became a series. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. To close this half of the show, here's a scene from the TV series in which Homer is trying to save the local burlesque house from an angry mob.
My friend, stop! Sure, we could tear this house down. No! My friend, stop! Let me finish. We could tear it down, but we'd be tearing down a part of ourselves. You could close down Moe's or the Quickie Mart, and nobody would care.
But the heart and soul of Springfield's in our Maison Derrière.
We're the sauce on your steak. We're the cheese in your cake. We put the spring in Springfield.
We're the lace on the nightgown.
The point after touchdown.
Spring in Springfield.
We're that little extra spice that makes existence extra nice. A giddy little thrill at a reasonable price.
Our only major quarrel's with your total lack of morals.
Our skimpy costumes ain't so bad.
They seem to entertain you, Dad.
The gin in your martini. The clams on your linguine. Yes, we keep the...
We remember our first visit.
The service was exquisite.
Why, Joseph, I had no idea.
Come on now, you were working here.
Without it, we'd have had no fun since March of 1961.
To shut them down now would be twisted.
We just heard this place existed.
We're the highlights in your hairdo.
The extra arms on Vishnu.
So don't.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Juno, starring Ellen Page, Michael Cera, Jennifer Garner, and Jason Bateman, now playing in select theaters. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the families who own Cabot Creamery, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar since 1919, recipes and health tips are at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, the voice of Bart Simpson. We talk with Nancy Cartwright about playing America's most famous 10-year-old boy, as well as some other characters on The Simpsons. And music critic Milo Miles looks at the career of guitarist Nils Lofgren. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
Hey, Bart, look at this. My dad took me to Circus of Values last night and said I could get anything I wanted.
Cool, an oversized novelty billiard ball.
Yeah, you shake it up and it tells the future.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Well, I passed my English test. Outlook not so good. Wow, it does work.
Let me try. Will I get beat up today? All signs point to yes.
That ball knows everything.
Two of the characters in that scene, Bart Simpson and Nelson Muntz, were voiced by our next guest, Nancy Cartwright. She's done Bart's voice since the start, back when The Simpsons originated as a series of roughly drawn shorts on The Tracy Ullman Show. Cartwright has aged 20 years in the interim, but Bart hasn't. He's still at the troublemaking age of 10. In addition to Bart and Nelson, Cartwright also provides the voices of Ralph Wiggum and Todd Flanders. She's done voices for other cartoons, too. And she's a star of The Simpsons movie, which just came out on DVD. Although she's the voice of Bart, she initially auditioned for the role of Lisa. When Terry spoke with Nancy Cartwright earlier this year, She told Terry how she approached that audition.
Well, you know, typically when I've gone in, I've been in the business since 1981, and I'll get a call for a part on, at that time, it was just syndicated television. It was Saturday Morning Fair, because there was no primetime animation in the early 80s. And I would go in for this Saturday morning, you know, My Little Pony, Glow Friends, Snorks, Pound Puppies, Richie Rich, that kind of stuff. And when I would audition, I would always tend to give three or four different takes on a character, because your idea of what a, you know, an eight-year-old pony sounds like may be different than the guy sitting next to you. So it'd be smart to give options and let them know I'm versatile, I can take direction, that kind of thing. But with Bart, I don't know. It's like, Terry, I had this idea. I read the script. I got the idea of who this boy was, saw the, you know, the monologue, and just boom, I just nailed it on one take. Didn't give him anything else. I gave him one shot, one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it. Blah, 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 blah. And Matt, his eyebrows went up. His tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh, my God, that's him. That's Bart. That's him. You got the part. And I was given the part on the spot.
So is it... There's nothing conscious going on when you do the voice. You just, it just came to you.
Yeah. It just, no kidding. When I saw the picture, it really helps when you get the visual image of what the character looks like. Because sometimes you might have a character whose jaw is sticking out a little bit more on the bottom than it is on the top. And he's got this sort of, there's a placement there. So you know that his lower teeth would be sticking out a little bit farther. So that would help in creating a character. Or say you've got a seven-year-old kid who's got a split in his two front teeth. Or he's missing one of his teeth at age seven.
So he would be talking sort of like this, and you can put a sort of a sound in there, sort of like that little actress that played on Mrs. Doubtfire.
So I can steal from, you know, Mara Wilson, I think was that little actress's name. I totally ripped that off from her.
What lines, what Bart lines do people quote at you most often when they meet you?
Well, when people meet me, and they'll mostly say, do Bart. That's how they do Bart, do Bart.
No way, man, and everybody's happy.
But I'll tell you, it creates such a great effect because they're blown away. Number one, that they heard it. Number two, that I did it without them asking. And I don't, number three, that it shocked them that I, you know, I suppose that I did it at all.
Well, why don't you describe who Nelson is and how you came up with his voice?
Well, Nelson, he was a bad boy, and I had to read the script because there's not much of a description in the script. It might say bad boy, but it didn't go into detail on it. So by reading the script and, you know, putting that in context, I realized he was just this, he was a thug. He was bigger physically than Bart. So he was also, I believe Nelson Muntz is a little bit older, even though he's in the fourth grade. But I just ended up coming up with the sound that I think Nelson has sort of evolved, and it came to the point where he eventually got a really, really rough sound like that. And he has got a really, really hard R's. And I don't know, that's how that sound came. And the laugh, the ha-ha, let me just say it for ha-ha, that was written in the script as it just said, I think it actually just said ha-ha. And I don't know. If somebody else would have been cast as that, they would have come up with their own idea of what that would sound like. But when I did that, it got an instant laugh. And so that stuck. And because I think it got that laugh, the writers put a little asterisk or a little star beside that. And they know that later on, they can do that again. And hopefully it'll continue to get a laugh. And it's through trial and error and through experimenting. I don't think anybody said, let's create a signature laugh for Nelson Muntz. Do you know what I mean? It's uh-huh. just something that sort of evolved. And I find that fascinating, too, in looking at the development of The Simpsons, that a lot of choices that we had the opportunity to make, they were just opportunities that we had. Nobody was going out there and saying, wow, when I do this, this is going to become a catchphrase. Next thing you know, this is... smell you later, that people are going to be saying that, you know?
When you do that gruff, like, Nelson voice, does that hurt your vocal cords at all? Like, is there a way of doing that without it hurting?
You know, he truly is he's the most challenging in terms of my vocal cords, but throughout the years and the 400-plus episodes that we've done so far, Nelson has only really been a lead lead character or citizen in a hand, you know, in just maybe a couple or three. One of my favorite ones was when it was that tribute when he came home and Marge really kind of took him under his wing and he sang that song. It was a tribute to, it was a play on Yentl. I don't know if I can do it.
Oh.
Papa, can you hear me? He's singing to his father. Because his father, left to go get cigarettes or milk or something at the Quickie Mart. He never came. Papa, is that you? Is that you? Oh, Papa.
That's so great. In the new Simpsons movie, as in the TV show, there are times when Homer strangles Bart.
Oh, sure.
So can you talk about what goes on between you and Dan Castellaneta when Homer's strangling Bart?
You know, that's another great one. I remember the first time that it was written in the script that happened, and I was just kidding. I said, Dan, why don't you come over and help me out? He did. He came across this, you know, he was standing on the opposite side of me. He walked all across the studio, stands behind me. He started choking me. I'm going, ah, 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 ah. And it, created that. And, man, it was imprinted forever, and that's what we duplicated from then on out.
Am I right in saying, based on your description, that when you're recording, the Simpsons movie or the TV show, that all the actors are in a room together, gathered around one or two microphones, but you're doing it in real time as a group?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's ideal. It's ideal that we're there so we can kind of play off of each other.
What's it like when you're doing both sides of the conversation? Say, Bart's talking to Nelson.
Yeah, that's fun. That's really, really fun. There was one show, I think it was a take on I think it was called Bart's Commandments, or it was some Ten Commandments show. It was a play on, took you back in time, and there was a scene where it was Bart, Nelson, Ralph, and Kearney, I believe. And, oh my God, the scene was 3 pages long, and I was just talking to myself the entire time. And I remember doing it at the table read. I was so nervous to do it in front of that. Oh, there's 100 people in the room, and I'm doing it just praying that I wouldn't get confused who I was. And I finished my run, and I was sweating. I was, really perspiring, and I was out of breath. There's no time to even breathe, practically. That is such a challenge. And yet, but if it's just, one scene, there was one scene where Bart had a Mr. Microphone, and he was in the bottom of the well pretending like he was somebody else, and Rod and Todd Flanders were next door, and they were picking him up on their radio. And Bart's like, Rod, Todd, this is God. What are you doing on our radio? What do you mean, what am I doing on the radio? I created the universe, stupid kid. What do you want from us? I want you to go to the kitchen and bring forth all the cookies from your kitchen. But those are our parents' cookies. What do you want, a happy God or a vengeful God? Happy God, happy God. Then bring forth the cookies. Yes, sir. It's a challenge, but it's fun.
Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with Nancy Cartwright. On The Simpsons, and in The Simpsons movie, now out on DVD, she gives voice to the characters of Bart Simpson, Nelson Muntz, and Todd Flanders.
Is there ever a time when you're given a script and you're thinking, I really need to see a visual to get what's going on here, to get what Bart is actually experiencing?
Wow, that's another great question. No. Actually, no, but I think partially is that especially after all these years, we can totally visualize what's going on. But you just got to do your homework. You just got to be prepared and know that if Bart is, you know, on a skateboard or he's riding his bicycle over a cliff and down a hill, that there's going to be,
huh?
you know, and I just visualize it and like, how many seconds of this do you want? Well, make it a little bit longer. Do it again, but make it longer. Nancy, you know what? This isn't a show about him riding, you know, his bicycle over a cliff. Just cut it. Like, you got to cut that about, just give me about a tenth of that. Yeah, okay, good, no problem. Because I don't know about the length of time for the animation.
Now, your mentor was Dawes Butler, who worked for Hanna-Barbera doing a lot of the great voices, Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw McGraw, Elroy Jetson. were you lucky enough to meet him?
Oh, my gosh, that's right. I was working at this radio station, and long story short, I connected up with someone who gave me her business card, and she forwarded my letter on to somebody else who then wrote me back, and in a letter was his name and phone number, and I called him up. And there, he had an answering machine, and this was like in 77. We didn't have answering machines in Dayton, Ohio, but this was Hollywood, you know. So I called him up and listened to his message, and it was a kind of an uptight kind of a butler guy.
Yes, hello, this is Percival Pickles, Mr. Butler's butler. Leave your name and address and leave your message, and he'll get back to you. Wait for the beep. Beep.
And I listened to that thing, and I'm like, oh, my God. I said, hello, Mr. Butler. This is Nancy Cartwright of Dayton, Ohio. And I just did a little character in return and left my, you know, left my address. And then I hung up the phone. I left my address. I said, just send me, you know, I said something like, please send me some information about your workshop. I'm interested in doing that. So pip, pip, cheerio, and I hung up the phone. And I thought, you know, that was stupid. Why didn't I just leave my phone number? So I called him back. And I'm telling you, something like that, I think that impinges on somebody. He listened to my messages, and sure enough, he called me back. And here we are talking on the phone, and he's telling me a little bit about his workshop. And he said, I'll just send you something. You take a look at it and see what you think. Maybe you could put it on tape and send me the tape of it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you've got to be kidding me. Wow, okay, I'll do it. And thank you, Mr. Butler, and hung up the phone. And that started a long-distance student-mentor relationship that continued until, like about a year or so later, I knew I had to get out of there. I wanted to go be with him.
And did you do that?
Yeah, I transferred. I told my mom and dad I wanted to move to California, and you're going to go with me, and we'll, you know, I'll transfer to UCLA, and I got accepted and got in their theater department. But I lived for the Sundays that I caught the bus in Westwood, and I rode the bus to Beverly Hills and hopped off, walked a couple blocks to his house. He'd converted his garage into a studio. And I'd go back there for a one-hour lesson that lasted like the whole afternoon. He and his wife pretty much took me under their wings. And I mean, this was like, this guy really, really cared for me. It was a pretty special relationship.
What are some of the things that you learned by watching Dawes Butler work? I assume maybe like you went with him to Hanna-Barbera and watched him record cartoons. Was he retired by then?
Let's see. When he took me to Hanna-Barbera, no, he wasn't retired. He was still doing, he was doing Popeye. I think he was Wimpy, the guy that eats all the hamburgers.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing that. He was still doing Elroy. They were still doing the Jetsons, believe it or not. And here Dawes was well into his 70s. And, well, for that matter, Mel Blanc, same thing. He was into his 70s. And George O'Hanlon, who did the voice of George Jetson, he was in his 80s and still doing it. This is what amazes me. Okay, I'm about 5 Barts worth. I'm way, way younger than, like, being into my 70s. I'm looking at The Simpsons and going, wow, is it possible that we could still be around for another 20 years? But you know what? Dave Merkin, at 200 episodes, Dave Merkin said at one of the table reads, well, we're halfway there. And it got a huge laugh, and then look what it...
You said earlier that, you know, when like a lot of friends of yours who have children, or, you know, people you're just meeting who have children will introduce the kids to you and say, this is Nancy Cartwright, and she does the voice of Bart. And then they'll expect you to do the voice of Bart for the kids. What about your own kids? I mean, they grew up while you were doing The Simpsons. Did they do like Mommy, Mommy, do Bart for us?
As a parent, you kind of wonder what kind of influence you have on your kids in everything that you're doing, whether it's traveling, you know, to different countries or whatever. But when my son Jack was 2 years old, they had come out with a Bart Simpson. It was a prototype to see if the talking Bart doll would work. But the string on the thing was a little short, so it sort of sounded like Bart on helium, because it would be like, "Don't have a cow, man. Don't have a cow, man." But my son would pull the string, and it would say that, and he'd look at the string, and then he'd look at me. He'd pull it again, "Don't have a cow, man." And he'd look at me, and he'd say to me, "Mommy, I don't see you in there. I don't see you in there." He's 2 years old. I'm telling you, that is a concept. Parents will come up to me and you know, I know that they want to hear me do the voice. But there's a 3-year-old clutching onto mama's skirt and they're saying, "Could you do it for Sally? Could you do it?" And I'm thinking, I'll just tell the parent, I don't have anything vested in this for a 3-year-old kid that looks scared to death. If I was to lean down and say, "Hi, I'm Bart Simpson. Who the hell are you?" You think that kid is going to like it? The kids look at me like I'm, you know, an alien, or they get upset. So I'll just say, "Look, I'll do it for you, but I'm not going to do it for your child. I just think that that's wrong.
Why do the kids get so upset?
Well, it's too big of a concept. They're looking at this woman who, they might watch The Simpsons, but a kid, I don't know, man. I don't know how old I was before I realized that those sounds came from actors. It's a concept that's pretty, you know, I'd say 5 and under. Just, this is a gross generalization. There are exceptions to the rule, no doubt about it. But generally speaking, I use some discretion on who I just throw that voice to.
Well, Nancy Cartwright, it's just been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, you bet.
Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. The Simpsons movie is now out on DVD.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me? Papa, can you find me in the night? Papa, are you near me? Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you help me not be frightened? Looking at the skies, I seem to see a million eyes. Which ones are yours?
I gotta do something about him.
Coming up, music critic Milo Miles on some new CDs featuring old music by veteran guitarist Nils Lofgren. This is Fresh Air. Sometimes, familiar sidemen in star bands have fascinating buried histories. For example, Barry Tashian, the guitarist for Emmylou Harris for many years, once led the garage rockers The Remains, who opened for the Beatles. Likewise, one long-term guitarist for Bruce Springsteen, Nils Lofgren, has a lengthy and interesting history. Music critic Milo Miles explains how that history has been revealed recently through reissues on CD.
Anymore. Even casual Bruce Springsteen fans know Nils Lofgren as the longtime E Street Band guitarist, the one who can play while he does backflips on a trampoline. More dedicated Neil Young followers will know Lofgren as an early hired gun with the band Crazy Horse. And anyone who zeroes in on Lofgren himself will know about his band Grin and his solo career, which took off with high expectations in the mid-70s and then faltered. Even with all that recognition, it's been hard to fully appreciate Lofgren's talent until now. All his finest LPs have finally been reissued, including his masterpiece, Back It Up, which was never officially released. What's nearly as sharp, however, is the import disc that combines the finest Grin releases, 1+1 and All Out. You hear a lot of dubious claims about lost should have been huge hits. Well, White Lies on 1+1 is the real deal.
Clear seas, clear, but I fear I traveled here alone 'cause of you. Think I may be daydreaming, baby, but I know what I still don't mean to you. While I try,
you also hear dubious claims that a performer doesn't fit into any category. But that's indeed true about Lofgren, both with the band and solo. He's not power pop or glam or hard rock, but with the perspective of time, Nils Lofgren sounds more and more like a rough equivalent of, well, Bruce Springsteen. His ballads suggest beefy brill-building tunes from the early 60s. His up-tempo numbers deliver British invasion through American ears, polished garage rock. Lofgren himself noted that his ballads and rockers had trouble flowing together track by track. I think the problem is his soft, rather limited voice, which means the music has to really hush up for the slow ones. This is not to suggest he doesn't provide lovely, evocative tunes, as with the title track to All Out.
I'm sitting in the street with a bottle. It's empty and my heart is too. My candle of fears just melted to tears. At dawn I must light something new. All out, I guess now.
Lofgren's 1975 solo debut, just called Nils Lofgren, has also been reissued, and it's a bright, tuneful affair, with more offhand grace than he would ever manage again. If it doesn't sound like a fresh breath of plain rock and roll sanity as it did back then, there's still not a weak tune on it. But the best place to hear it, and a choice selection of Grin numbers, is on Back It Up, recorded live in San Francisco's KSAN studio before a small audience. It became a so-called authorized bootleg, released only to the press and radio. A shame, because it's his most vibrant document. Nowadays, it may seem bizarre to feature a tune that begs Keith Richards not to break up the Rolling Stones, but it's worth it because you can really hear how Lofgren was affected by Jimi Hendrix. The highlight of Back It Up is Lofgren's cover of Carole King's Goin' Back, a deaf number that celebrates the energy and clear ideals of youth. Here, with a torrid keyboard accompaniment by his brother Tom and Al Cooper, Lofgren at last mixes his sweet and romping sides, balances his innocence and bravado. His early years didn't lead to the stardom he deserved, but on these albums he proves them were the days.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. The 1 plus 1 and All Out combination CD appears on the British Acadia label. The Nils Lofgren and Back It Up CDs are on the Hip-O Select label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Herzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What is wrong with the world today?
What's wrong with the world today?
On the New Year's Eve edition of Fresh Air, the best of this year's in-studio concerts with Flight of the Conchords, Nellie McKay, and Los Straitjackets featuring Big Sandy. Join us for some great music on the next Fresh Air.
Put into a can and all the money that we're making is going to the man.
What man? Who's the man? When's a man a man? What makes a man a man? Am I a man? Is Brett a man? Yes, technically he is.